Welcome to the Who Cares podcast, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at Georgia Southern University.
Welcome back to Who Cares, casual conversations with Southern scholars. Today, Ryan and I are pleased to bring you Dr. Jennifer Sweeney Tooks from the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences. She is an assistant professor of sociology and anthropology. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
We are pleased to have you here. So I am very interested in to learn a little bit more about your research. I've done a little bit of reviewing, but why don't you kind of sum it up for us in a nutshell?
All right. In a nutshell, I am an applied cultural anthropologist. I do work mostly with fishing communities, people who live by the sea and coastal communities, and those who work with seafood and seafood processing. And I concentrate mainly on the South Atlantic in Georgia, South Carolina, and then also in the Caribbean. I did my dissertation work in Barbados, and I work in the Virgin Islands now on St. Thomas and St. Croix.
Okay, excellent. So just for our listeners who may not be familiar with what cultural anthropology is, what do you do with these people?
That's a great question. So the goal of anthropology is to understand the viewpoint of the people that you are working with. And as an anthropologist, we often, and as an applied anthropologist especially, we're generally looking for human problems that exist and trying to find ways to ask questions and understand that problem in a deeper way so that we can get to some sort of actual solutions to some of the problems they're experiencing.
Awesome.
Ryan? Jennifer, tell us about some of the work that you've done in the Caribbean, specifically with the fishing communities and some of the goals of that work.
So my dissertation work didn't actually concentrate on fish. It concentrated on food in Barbados, which then translated really conveniently and naturally over to a project that we did with invasive lionfish in St. Croix and St. Thomas. We knew that there were fishing communities that were struggling financially, as they often do, and that there was an increasing number of invasive lionfish surrounding the islands. And these are fish that belong in the Indo-Pacific. They do not belong in the Caribbean or the Atlantic. And so they have no natural predators here. And so fishers were increasingly competing with these voracious lionfish to catch snapper and grouper and spiny lobster, which is what they've traditionally fished. And so we set out to look at all of the different angles of this problem from a social side, not necessarily from the biological side, but, you know, who is being affected most by these fish being in the water? Are these a good food source? And could fishermen exploit those fish? Could that also then give snapper, grouper, and spiny lobster a bit of a rest if they're not being harvested quite as much? And then what could they do with those fish? Who would eat them? And so we looked at it from all those different angles. We did a long series of quantitative surveys and qualitative interviews with tourists, with local consumers, with local markets, with local restaurants, with fishermen themselves, with government agencies, to really look at all the different angles of this problem and figure out why is it that people aren't catching lionfish and what can be done to encourage them to catch lionfish.
So these fish came into the waters in a way that they weren't supposed to be there.
Right.
Right? And the fishermen were encountering these fish and throwing them back.
Well, you don't want to touch them, actually. And this is what really sort of started the problem. It's that when they started showing up, they have venomous spines along their back and in their tail and in some of their side fins. And so if you touch them, it sticks you and you have a reaction like a bee sting. It hurts. It's not fun. And so early education efforts on the islands were aimed mostly at tourists. And so they said, you know, pictures of the lionfish and then dangerous, caution, poisonous. But they're not actually poisonous. If you eat them, they're not poisonous. And so that sort of stuck and they just had a really bad rap and no one wanted to deal with them. Understandably, if you could go after other fish that didn't sting you back, you would just try to avoid the lionfish. But unfortunately, that let them then be really successful. They breed really high rates, and they eat almost everything. They're like little vacuum cleaners in the water, eating up all the juvenile fish. And so they avoided them for a very long time, and people took away the message from those signs as being, these are dangerous. We shouldn't, not only should we not touch them, but we shouldn't eat them. They're probably poisonous.
And so as an applied anthropologist, you take this information, and you go into the community and do what?
Well, so we actually asked them, you know, what would make you want to catch these fish? What are you worried about? And for the fishermen, you know, what are the obstacles that you perceive them to be? And then with the consumers or with the markets or with the restaurants, you know, are you interested in this fish? What would persuade you to try to sell this fish? And then tourists, of course, are excited. They're somewhere new. They want to try something exciting. And that sounds really exotic. You know, so again, what would it take for you to be interested in consuming this? And at the end of the day, what we found is that consumers were just a little concerned, right? It sounds pretty fierce. It's a lionfish. And they didn't see it very often. And so they really just needed someone to tell them, hey, this is safe. You can eat this. Watch me. I'm eating it first, you know, and put it on menus at price points that they could afford. And fishers didn't want to get stung, and they're not going to catch something that doesn't have a market. It's a very much fish to demand market in the Caribbean, at least on these islands. And so if they know, well, I have, you know, Miss Jones, who is going to buy 5 red snapper from me every Friday, they're not going to go out and look for lionfish. They're going to go out and look for Miss Jones' 5 red snapper. And so what they told us is, if I knew I wouldn't get stung, and if I knew that I had customers, well, then I would probably fish these, you know, depending on the price points. And so we went back, then we gathered data our first summer, and we had a team of graduate students on the island. We took one of the project primary investigator took a team of undergrad students to the island for a week and did all the tourist surveys. So after we had all that data and we really looked at what is stopping people on all the different sides of this problem, we went back the second summer and said, okay, here's what you told us, that you needed to know more about it. Well, here's a lot of fact sheets. Here's information sheets. We developed a logo, Eat the Enemy, and a picture of a lionfish in 3 languages, right? Because they speak French and Spanish and English on the islands. We made t-shirts that had that logo on it. We gave the fishermen what we called the lionfish response kits. So it had a t-shirt with the logo. You can start a conversation with your regular customers about how this is a safe thing to eat. It had atlases about where we were told the lionfish were and the biggest concentrations. We did a lot of spatial analysis and some mapping with them as well. And a lionfish sting kit. So if you do get stung, here's the kit, everything you need, right? Get the hot pack on your hand and seal it up with a Band-Aid. You'll be fine. And then shears, puncture-resistant gloves. So we taught them, okay, if you put these gloves on and use these shears, you can just cut those spines right off. And once you cut the spines off, you just have a normal fish. It's fine to handle. So we took all of that back and gave them response kits. We held tasting events all over the island. We had some of the best chefs on the island volunteer their time. And some of the dive groups volunteered to help some of our grad students go dive for lionfish. So we were literally handing people plates of cooked lionfish out on rainbow beaches, Sunday fun day. You know, and it seemed to make an impact. As we've gone back later years, we've seen lionfish on menus that didn't used to have lionfish, and people saying, oh yeah, lionfish, I eat it now, it's no big deal, they cut the spines off for me.
Perfect. So this project is part cultural, right, changing mm-hmm. cultural impressions, but it's also economic, mm-hmm. so that the fishermen can sustain their livelihood and the restaurants can continue to sell meals. And and then on top of all of that, it seems to be an ecological project as well, in terms of sustainability of the wildlife.
Okay, getting rid of those invasive species in a way that's sort of cyclical, comes back.
Exactly.
So I kept having this image of you, like, doing the tastings in the grocery stores. You know, would you like to try a little lionfish?
I have a lovely field photo of me in a swimsuit on an ice chest cutting spines off of lionfish and handing them to the chef. Yeah, it's a very applied project.
Can't get any fresher than that. So that was in Barbados.
That was in St. Croix and St. Thomas.
Okay, so that's a little closer than Barbados up to us. So here we are on the Georgia coast. I know that lionfish are becoming sort of prevalent out there at Gray's Reef. What are we finding the same situation here on our coast and up the coast down in Florida with the reasons people are maybe not sure what to do with this fish?
See, and this is where it gets tricky location-wise, right? In St. Croix and St. Thomas, well, especially in St. Croix, they're mostly spear fishers and they're diving for the fish. So they see them and they're very easy to catch. The lionfish are slow and lazy. And so they're very easy to spear.
It's because they're eating a lot.
But exactly. They can't move much after that. But they catch them off of the Keys in Florida and up until about the point where there's not as many spear fishermen. They have not, to this point, developed a really reliable trap one of the graduate students who went to St. Croix with us is actually just finished at the University of Florida and has developed a trap they actually think is pretty effective. But there's no way to target lionfish the way that we target other species that we fish for. So especially off the coast of Georgia, our waters have so much of the tannins from, you know, being really healthy and coming down through the estuaries that you don't go into the water off Georgia and you're not able to see really clearly where those lionfish are like you can in the Caribbean. So to the best of my knowledge, no one's really targeting them here. There are a few spear fishermen in Georgia, but the last I heard, because it's all, you know, word of mouth, trying to do anthropology, it's very much trying to stay plugged into the community, is they didn't have enough buyers, so they didn't want to target them. Okay. In Florida, they do.
So again, that cultural piece that might be coming up now from the Caribbean islands up through Florida, maybe following the progress of the lionfish. On Georgia, then, well, let's talk about their coast a little bit. As a cultural anthropologist, what are you seeing as the stories that the fishermen are telling you with our coast?
They're so very different, actually. And that's what's intriguing to me as an anthropologist. The culture of fishing is very different in Georgia and in South Carolina than it is in the Caribbean. The people who are fishing in Georgia especially, many of them have been doing this for generations. The style of fishing is different. We have a lot of shrimp birds in Georgia, a lot of targeting of the wild Georgia shrimp. We have a few finfish boats. We have some master shellfish pickers who are pulling in wild oysters. And we have a few clam growers. I believe there's 7 right now in the state. But we predominantly focus on shrimp as our main seafood that we're harvesting. We also harvest a lot of cannonball jellyfish, which we export to Asia. They're very popular in Asian markets. So that, like, for dollar value, we actually catch more jellyfish than probably anything else. I know, everyone's making faces at me, but it's true. So we send those out, though.
Those are, just to clarify, because nobody can get a visual of this, that's just your standard looking jellyfish. You try to avoid at all costs.
Well, the cannonball jellyfish are a little funny looking. I mean, they're sort of the size and shape of a cannonball. And then out the bottom, they have some stubby little tentacles that come out. They don't have the long drifting ones like a man of war or the ones you really worry about.
What are the jellyfish we worry about on the beaches?
Portuguese man of war. What else is here? Don't spend a lot of time in our water here. I can't see what's in it.
They usually have longer tentacles, and occasionally you get stung by a piece of tentacle that has come off. But I don't know that I've... Where do the big cannonball jellyfish are out in the deep more?
They are. It's fairly deep. I mean, they're probably about between 6 and 10 inches in diameter. They're just a big, round, heavy ball.
Okay. Well, I don't know, you know, biology is, you know, that's part of cultural anthropology, but that's not really what we study, but... never heard of it called a cannonball jellyfish. Mm-hmm. I've onto jellyfish before, which was not fun.
And they call them jelly ball. They go jelly balling when the shrimp are not in season. They go jelly balling.
Okay, so do the shrimpers are catching these as a secondary part of their livelihood? So the shrimp is the most important commodity that they're bringing in or resource that they're bringing in, and then the jellyfish...
Mainly. When jelly balls are in, depending on the price in the Asian markets, this is what I'm told, that the price in the Asian markets will determine whether or not they're going to trawl for shrimp or they're going to go looking for jelly balls.
Okay, so that's really interesting to me because we talk about how we're trying, you know, there's a push for sustainable seafood and locally harvested seafood and things, and how we're getting the shrimp inland, and, you know, you've got to be able to figure out a way to keep that fresh from the coast up through the state into Atlanta and Athens and those types of areas. How on earth do you keep jellyfish fresh?
You don't.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't. Now we're getting out a bit and not my focus, but they process them with lime and alum, I believe. So they do several baths. They basically kind of dehydrate them before they ship them, and then they rehydrate them and process them in Asia.
So our fishermen figured this out? It's pretty amazing. I mean, I will get back onto the shrimp here.
Yeah,
it's a whole different topic.
I'm trying to remember. You know, the jellyfish are out there, and they've known this, because some of the first, talk about environmental impact, some of the first turtle excluder devices were developed by shrimpers who wanted to stop catching so many of these cannonball jellyfish, because they're heavy and they start to break things. So they've known they were out there, but for a long time there wasn't a market, and then they did eventually, I'm not sure, I could look it up for you. I'm sure I've got it somewhere. But at some point, we realized, oh, wait, we could export this. And now there are several businesses that just focus on that.
It still does help with a commodity and economic exchange.
Exactly.
I know in the past there have been, in recent years, actually big issues with harvesting the Georgia shrimp, the wild Georgia shrimp. And I'm wondering how this whole push for sustainability and locally grown resources is impacting our fishermen.
Well, if you want to buy sustainable seafood, then wild-caught American seafood is your absolute best bet.
Okay.
I mean, at the end of the day, the environmental restrictions on commercial fishing in the U.S. are far more stringent than they are in most other places in the world. So our shrimpers are really, really strictly regulated. We also have, they pull turtle excluder devices, they pull bycatch reduction devices hooked into their nets. In fact, they created, one of the most popular versions was crafted by a shrimper here in Georgia. And we have the highest compliance rates in the country here in Georgia. They aren't quite as willing to do it in the Gulf. Maybe don't tell people in Gulf that. But our rates of compliance are really high here. And so because we regulate the fisheries so strictly and because shrimp are a seasonal crop, you know, once they come out into those waters where the shrimpers shrimp for them, they're going to die anyway. They're not going to reproduce past that point. So it's one of the most sustainable seafoods that you can buy anywhere.
That's great. And so you've been working with chefs in the state on a project. Can you tell us about that?
So one of our first projects here in Georgia, we knew that we have shrimp and really fresh seafood on the coast, and we know that we had a really large local foods movement in Atlanta and Athens, and so we couldn't figure out why we had these really complementary issues and what the problem was. And so we set out to figure out if direct marketing was an opportunity for shrimpers and fishers. We often say fishers to catch all of them in that term, but if that was an opportunity for them to make a bigger profit and to get some of that seafood onto people's plates and restaurants, right, with chefs who really cared about the quality of the product. And so we did, I can't even remember, dozens of interviews and surveys at farmers markets and with chefs. And we're currently interviewing chefs about oysters as well and trying to figure out local or interest in Georgia for local oysters. Should we be able to start doing commercial oyster aquaculture?
So are you guys talking to the chefs or the shrimpers, fishers talking directly to the chefs? Is there it's like a taboo to talk to the chef between the shrimper, or is it just, it just doesn't happen?
You know, that's a fun question. It just doesn't happen. And as an anthropologist, this is often where we find ourselves, right, in this spot as a cultural broker between groups of people who maybe just don't quite speak the same language. You know, chefs have a certain sort of lifestyle, a certain schedule that their lives are set by, a certain set of needs when it comes to product. Fishers also have a certain way of communicating, a certain way of doing things. And these are not really two groups that are known for being super friendly and amenable and wanting to go out and chat people up all day, necessarily. Chefs more so. There's a reason fishers choose to be alone on the water for most of their lives. And so there's often not a lot of patience between groups. And so as part of these projects, we're often taking what information we gather, what data we gather, and translating that back to the other community. You know, when we talk to people in Atlanta, we would say, we understand you think you want fresh shrimp, but let's talk about what fresh looks like. You don't live on the coast. So don't you think you'd rather they freeze it on the boat so that when you defrost it in your kitchen, it's very fresh and lovely? You know, and sort of doing that education and then going back to the coast and saying, I know you don't want to hear that they care about environmental sustainability, but hear us out. You are actually fishing in a very environmentally sustainable way, and here's why, and here's how. You know, and trying to translate that information between two different groups of people who maybe wouldn't necessarily be on the same page if they sat down at the same table.
So if I'm a chef in Atlanta and I want fresh seafood on my menu, am I getting it from Georgia fishers and shrimpers, or am I getting it from people in the Gulf of Mexico or somewhere else in the world?
That's a great question. So most of Georgia's seafood goes up and down I-95, and most of it doesn't make it inland. Some of it does. But commercial shrimping, the way that it developed in this state, had a lot to do with the building of 95 in the 70s and the ability of large commercial distributors to be able to send refrigerated trucks from Florida all the way up to New England. And so they'll stop at a regular time on a regular schedule and they'll pick up that seafood. If you wanted to go inland, those market chains just never developed. And so getting seafood inland is a really confusingly difficult task in Georgia, because the market chains, the commodity chains just didn't develop there. And so chefs in Atlanta, some of them, if they're really determined, have found ways around this and have developed relationships. And there are some small niche marketers who will drive their pickup trucks with their big, huge, like freezer things in the back of the pickups down to the docks, and they'll pick up the shrimp and then they'll drive them up to the restaurants, right? But that's niche market and it's really expensive.
Images of the Cannonball Run.
That's wonderful to know that people are going through those efforts.
They really are. I mean, there's a restaurant in Macon where the owner every week drives down to a specific dock. I've seen him load up there and drives that shrimp and that seafood back up to his restaurant in Macon. But those are the sorts of solutions that people have found, because there's not really an established infrastructure for that.
So outside of the niche markets and those extraordinary efforts to get fresh Georgia fish and shrimp to the restaurants, if I had a restaurant in Atlanta, it's most likely I'm going through some big distributor that's getting fish from everywhere, right?
Because if you're trying to cook a certain number of meals every day and you know that your customers want to see shrimp and they want to see fish on the menu, you need it to be consistent. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the trick.
But breaking down this logistics problem, which is essentially what it is, would be good for fishers and shrimpers, as well as for the restaurants in Atlanta to have the fresher seafood. But ultimately, we're talking about economic development. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity to fix a problem that can benefit us all.
Wow. Really cool. Exactly.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm thinking back, you know, when you said the advent of 95, I was just going to ask you, you know, you've done, I'm sure, a lot of, you know, social histories of these shrimpers. You said they've been in these careers for, you know, generations. I mean, I'm sure they've seen a change. And have they... what is it that they want as their outcome from this?
That is a great question. And I almost feel like we've spent years trying to get at that. I mean, we started working here in 2013, and so it's been 8 years now we've been working on the Georgia coast. They would like to see shrimping and fishing continue in the state. They'd like to see it continue to be an economically viable way of life for their children. But they, in many cases, feel that they're experiencing what one of my colleagues calls the death by 1,000 paper cuts. You know, every year, the amount of shrimp imported from other nations increases, and the price of that is so much lower than what you can sell a wild-caught local product for. Every year, the price of gas goes up. Every year, those boats get older, mm-hmm. and they're wood boats, most of them, with some fiberglass added or some steel added, but they age and they get worn so, you know, quickly. They are seeing children who don't necessarily want to work in the hot sun on a seasonal schedule where you can only shrimp according to the season set by the Department of Natural Resources and NOAA, and they're just not sure that that will continue.
That's sad. In a way,
it's really sad.
It's not just an economic impact, but it's a cultural way of life that has impacted our coast, mm-hmm. because without the fishermen, we wouldn't have people moving to the coast without the resources that were there. And so it does, it's going to take out a whole cultural aspect of our communities.
It's really changing it.
So Jennifer, the title of this podcast is Who Cares? And what we'd like to do is just have you explain the ultimate goal of your work and why people should be concerned about the work that you do.
Ultimately, my work is meant to help solve human problems. And if that problem is that your community is suffering because you're no longer able to make a good livelihood, then I would like to marshal and bring the resources of anthropology, but also my collaborators of economics and of political science to the table and look at how we can contribute information that might help sustain that life. If the issue is that fishermen in the Virgin Islands are competing with these lionfish and things aren't going so well, then how can we bring the resources that we have to help make positive changes in people's lives in the ways that they want to see those changes happening?
Great. And I'll just reiterate here, it's cultural, and it's economic, and it's ecological. And mm-hmm. you can do things that are ecologically mm-hmm. Effective that are also economically beneficial.
Right.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing I did want to mention is that a lot of our work also is filling a demand for science. The way that fisheries are regulated in the U.S., which means the Virgin Islands or here, is that they're regulated by regional fisheries management councils. And those management councils have science and statistics committees, and they have socioeconomic panels. And they are charged with regulating the fisheries in the U.S. such that they maintain an ecological and cultural balance. And so they're charged with taking all of the best available science, and taking that into account when they make decisions about catch limits or licensing. And so what I see as a social scientist, and what I think also drew me to a lot of this work, is that most of the best available science is biological. Mm-hmm. And there are really huge gaps in understanding of what knowledge we have about the social impacts of regulations or the impacts that these have on the local communities. And that's not to say that I don't think we should absolutely have fishing regulations, that we should be keeping a very close watch on the ecosystems and the health of our oceans, but that we could very easily then make sure that our local fishers or American fishers have been regulated out of business. And if that does happen, that does not mean we'll stop eating seafood. That just means right. We'll eat more and more of the imported seafood that doesn't meet any of these regulations at all. So I'd like to see that balance, and that's where I hope my work, and I see that my work fits in, is providing that best available social science to decision makers and policymakers.
And if we keep eating that shrimp from other places, our money
goes to
the
other
state
places.
And goes to other places.
Exactly.
And so it's a feedback loop that if we can get in there and work on the cultural issues and mm-hmm. be mindful of the biology, but also keep that emphasis on the human side of the equation, we can all win.
Exactly.
Well, and I think that brings up something that I've often thought about when, you know, the government, and air quotes around it, comes in and wants to do some sort of, you know, socio-impact study. I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of these fishers either don't feel comfortable coming to the table, they're scared to come to the table, they're wary of coming to the table, so their voice never gets heard. Because the people whose voices are getting heard are those that, A, have the time, the education, for a manner of speaking, that are going to hit the table running. So they
don't
feel
welcome. You're exactly right. And that really sort of brings us to what I end up doing most of the time. Very, very seldom am I sitting in my office looking at all of the survey data that's come rolling into me. My life in gathering data is generally me eating gnats on the end of a dock that's falling down, begging someone who doesn't trust me at all to please just talk to me a little bit, because his perspective is important. And he might think everyone knows this, but they don't. Mm-hmm. So that's what my research looks like most of the time. It's promising them, I do not work for the government. I'm a college professor. Look at my hat. But what you think is important, and your voices won't be heard unless enough of you speak. And we try to explain, you know, that one person's story is their story, but if we hear the same story over and over and over and again from multiple people, then that's data, that's qualitative data. And once we write that and we publish that in a journal, that is science. And now that has to be listened to and taken into account. So yes, I'm trying to give that voice. Thank you.
That's wonderful, because I think that voice is oft overlooked, especially with our marginalized communities who have been fishing the coast for long periods of time and have ways and means of doing this that are not often considered, but also have some knowledge on how to do things that large commercial industries may not. So I'd like to thank you so much for the work you're doing. I'm very excited about this, and I'm really thinking, gosh, it seems like such an easy thing to solve with this logistics. You know, maybe I'll just go run some shrimp up to Atlanta. But it there is so much more involved than just this easy, like, we'll just put it on a truck and go. But I think your work is very impactful, and I very much want to have you back and talk a little bit more about this in the future.
Absolutely. I'd love to. You can tell I do like to talk about my work. I think it's exciting, so I'm always glad to have a captive audience.
It is. It is very exciting, especially for those of us. I've grown up on the coast. I don't have fishers in my family as far as commercial fishermen, but I know the impact that it can have, and it is crucial that we, you know, make people aware of it and preserve the cultural heritage that it has brought to us.
Great work, Jennifer. I love the impact.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me. Casual Conversations with Southern Scholars, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at George Southern University. The opinions expressed here are those of the researchers and the host and not of Georgia Southern University or the University System of Georgia. We would like to give a shout out to Purple Planet for our bumper music. Join us next time for Who Cares? Casual Conversations with Southern Scholars.